Blasted out of my sleep 6 o'clock in the morning. Some maniac outside leaning on his car horn. Gotta go outside and teach him the proper etiquette. Neighborhood bad enough, can't let it get worse than it already is. You hear me? Do y'all hear me? I need my sleep. That's the only time on this planet that I ever get any peace. I tried that college thing on some American dream tip, but yet I still live on the same street that I grew up on. Them same streets that I grew tough on. My mother hoped that I would surpass at least to the middle class, but yet I'm still stuck on that same mentality. And all them years of college ain't even challenged me. But when I graduated, life was right there to put a degree in my hands and a foot on my chest. And here I am dressed in my pajamas and no slippers, about to run outside and rip the backbone out this fool. Ain't got nothing to show for all them years of school but bad credit. And even worse decisions. And I live in a neighborhood where people buy food on credit, so they finance what they don't just take, and they're making payments on food that they already ate. And when they see me on the street, they're looking at me like they're about to break, and I'm snatching open this door like I'm about to break, and I see my best friend. And he's sitting in the minivan with four of those child car seats, and he's looking at me with a gun in his hand. It's like I can hear his heartbeat. And with his other hand, he takes a swig of liquor from a bottle of scotch, pops the door locks like, get in, again. Moves the pictures of his children off the car seat with the gun, throws them in the glove box, then it's like everything stop. And we drive, and we drive, and we drive till we get to the part of town where it seems like the American dream is still alive. And in my mind, I'm playing Nina Simone as I'm looking out the window on the passenger side. And it's like somebody scraping their fingernails along my bones as I feel this grown man cry. And I wonder if he knows that tens of millions of people in this country are depressed but using alcohol or drugs to remain in denial. I wonder if he knows that there's a suicidal tendency hiding behind almost every smile, because no matter how many times they go back to school or how many jobs they work simultaneously, they could never seem to permanently change their lifestyle. But somehow, they convince themselves that it'll be different for their children. And eventually, they'll realize that's a fantasy, but they need something to believe in until then. And him, he just wants to be a father to his children. But sometimes, y'all, after all the love is gone, children become pawns in a relationship. Relationship with his children is the vehicle that his ex-wife chooses to take out her frustrations with, and if he's just one day late on the child support, she reports it to the courts. And what's driving him crazy is yesterday, he just got laid off. Now, 30 days ago, her and the kids just moved in with a new man who drives a Range Rover and plays golf, and that's a year ago from the day that my best friend had to go to jail for making her last boyfriend stop telling the children that their father was soft. And right now, he feels like everything's lost. That's why I'm glad he came to me to give me this opportunity to put a few thoughts across. And you see, all day and all night, we talk. And I tell him, a man is judged by what's in his soul and what's in his heart, and not just by what's in his pockets. I tell him, me and him are friends through thick and thin, and if he's in pain, we need to put our brains, time, and money together to stop it. I tell him, if the fact that we don't have a lot of money is a problem, then rather than getting fed up, what we need to do is wake up. And like Moses and Jacob, whenever we get together, just find new ways to profit. Because in my eyes, our friendship is how we live and how we die. And don't you ever believe, even for a second, that I would ever let you slide. Now, for what I'm about to say, I want you to listen with all your pride and sexuality aside, because as God is my guide, like my own self, I love you.
Welcome one, welcome all. This is the Next Step Radio Show on the Antimatter Radio Zone Network. I am your host, Jacob Appleman. My website, www.infowarts.com. That's infowarts.com. My email address is thenextstepradioshow@charter.net. That is thenextstepradioshow@charter.net. I'd like to thank Talon Macy up front. That is a piece of his called Brotherly Love. And we'll probably end the interview today with a little bit of Bob Marley. Just a quick intro here in episode number 23. We are going to be talking with one of the hosts of the talk show Ghost of the Republic. He goes by Paranoid the Patriot. And I guess we'll just get right into the interview, and he'll explain who he is and where he's at and how you can hear more of this. The topic today is, in general, the No State Project. This will be the first interview in a series as we explore this idea. So without any further ado, Paranoid Patriot from Ghost of the Republic. Thank you for joining us.
Any kind of government whatsoever that's ever existed has usually been out of necessity. And the necessity usually is, and it's fairly, it's pretty much just human nature. Some people are better at certain things and other people are better at other things. Not the reason that we have auto mechanics is because not everybody can fix a car. Even if you give them a Chilton's or a Haynes manual and you give them all the pieces, they still might not be able to look at it and fix that car. The reason that we have people to fix your computers is even if you have the manual or the internet to walk you through it, you might still not be able to do it. You just might not be electronically inclined like that. The reason that we've ever had government is from the same reason, and this goes all the way back to the very beginning when we were just, you know, 12 people huddled in a tribe. The strongest guy or the guy who knew the most about how the stars worked, you know, he said, okay, this is when the rains are coming. This is when we need to plant the food. This is when we need to harvest the food. This is when we need to get ready for the cold. You know, that person, because not everybody wants to learn these things and because not everybody even can learn these things, some people just aren't able to do it, that person would stand up and he would be the leader. And the reason that we would stand behind that leader is because he would offer us protection, whether it be from the elements, whether it be from enemies. The reason that we've always had any kind of, you know, real form of government is because the 99% rally behind the 1%, thinking that that 1% can protect the other 99%. And that was the philosophy that held true for any type of governing body, whether it's any kind, whether it's socialism, communism, fascism, capitalism, whatever it is, the main basic principle behind why people form governing parties is because the 99% want to be protected by the 1%. And when it started out in, you know, little tribal clans, and then it moved eventually to, you know, kingdoms and cities, and in England, when we had like the actual full kingdoms coming into play and battling other kingdoms, and, you know, this king over here, if he takes over, he's going to turn you into slaves, so keep paying your taxes to me because I'm protecting you from whenever he tries to come over here to fuck with you guys. And so the legitimacy, the necessity for any sort of state whatsoever comes from that. It comes from a reciprocal relationship between two parties, number one party being the 99%, and their obligation is a duty of allegiance, and then the other party, the 1%, and their obligation is a duty of protection. And there's Supreme Court hearings that have also ruled this, but I mean, it's just basic common knowledge. If your king proves that he can't protect you, his kingdom either falls to another king or his people have a coup and revolt against him and put a new leader in. So that's where the necessity of government comes from, is from, like I said, people's insecurities. They think as a 99%, they can't somehow do what the 1% can. And it might be more difficult for some of them. I don't want to say they can't do it, but that's the mindset that creates the power structure known as the state. So that's where the idea of the state comes from. But what people get confused is they take the idea and they transpose that on their reality. And this is where all titles of nobility, all forms of authority, whether it be scientific authority, whether it be religious authority, or whether it be political authority, all of these titles of authority are just figments of our imagination. An easy way to explain it is like the story of the emperor has no clothes. I mean, it was just a naked man and he was a fool. And the question really isn't, why isn't anybody saying he doesn't have clothes? The question is, why is everybody calling a naked man emperor? Like, right. It's a man. You put on a uniform and it doesn't give you authority. You put on a robe, it doesn't give you authority. You put on some naked clothes, it doesn't make you an emperor. All of these things are positions that we make up in our heads, or somebody else makes up in their head and forces upon us, usually at the edge of a sword or at the barrel of a gun. And so the whole idea of states is pretty much the same way. I mean, if today Mexico, quote-unquote, because I don't really, you know, the same way I feel about America is the same way I feel about Mexico. It's just an imaginary entity forced on the people that live on a geographical location. If the Mexican government, quote-unquote, decided to invade America and take over Texas and they won, then all of a sudden everybody in Texas would now be Mexicans instead of Americans. And so, I mean, how legitimate is the state of Texas if it can just be vanished and rewritten into the minds of men as a new entity just like that? You know, when Texas disappears or unincorporates, the ground doesn't disappear. The people that live there don't disappear. The only thing that disappears is the imaginary entity known as Texas. That's the only thing that disappears, is your imaginary, you know, vision that you have. So when it comes to like where everybody lives at, it's the same thing. I live in Colorado, you know, in layman's terms, I live in Colorado, but I actually live on a continent, and that's pretty much all it comes down to. I live on the land. I'm a man that lives on the land. And all of these things, I live in Colorado, I live in Fort Collins, all of these things are things that we've been taught our whole lives and seem natural to us because they've been forced into our brain from every single angle since we were children. But that's all they are, is they're imaginary things. When it comes down to, like, people say, oh, you know, you call someone and they're shopping in Walmart, and you're like, hey, where are you at? And they're like, I'm in Walmart. Well, the building is not Walmart. If Walmart went out of business, does that mean that the building would just simply vanish and disappear? No. If Target came in and took over and, you know, Walmart wasn't doing good there and Target bought the land and put a Target there, a year later you could be in the exact same geological location or geographical location, but you wouldn't be in Walmart. Now you'd be in Target. Why? Because, you know, what is Walmart? What is Target? Walmart is a stack of paperwork filed by lawyers and backed by a bunch of lawyers. Target is a stack of paperwork filed by lawyers and backed by a bunch of lawyers, but really all they are is imaginary entities that we as a people have let become more real than our actual authority. And it's the same thing when it comes to states. Colorado is it's a corporate municipality. The city of Fort Collins, which I live in, is a corporate municipality. The United States, a lot of people might not know this, but if you go to the U.S. Code and you look up the definition section of the U.S. Code and you look up United States, the United States is very clearly defined as a federal corporation. Most of the quote-unquote governments, which are not governments anymore, are registered corporations. And so what we live under right now is we live in a world where us, the living, sentient, sovereign, breathing, thinking, tangible, flesh and blood creations who have all authority and all rights, claim of rights to all of the resources of this planet and the entire universe, if we can grasp them, we're real, we're living, we're sentient, we have first claim to all of this stuff, and yet we live in a world now where we've created all of these entities, and I'm talking about legal fictions all the way from Walmart to the United States of America. These are all legal fictions. They're things that only exist in the collective imagination. And we live in a world where we've let these imaginary entities take control over the resources, over our lives, over the water, over the plastic, over the fuel, over our travel, over everything. So we've let figments of our imagination take control over our entire reality. And so where I come from, and other people that have helped me along my path, including Mark Stevens, including Tactical Guy One, he's on YouTube, he's got a lot of really good videos on this stuff as well. Where I come from is just that basic mentality, okay, the state is coming against me, or the city is coming against me, and they want to prove that I owe them somehow because I trespassed on their sacred law. Well, when I go in there with one understanding. They're not real. It's not, their entire system is not real. It's all part of the collective imagination. And I want one thing. I want them to prove with facts that they have standing to complain against me and that they have any sort of authority over me. And just by doing that, instead of going in and arguing, because I've done this, I've gone into court and I've argued, you're not real, there's a conflict of interest, you don't have authority, I'm a sovereign, and I've failed miserably. By going in and asking questions, though, instead of making statements, by going in and asking questions and saying, look, I'm not informed here, I don't understand what's going on, I just got a couple of questions I need to ask you, and by boxing them into a position where they have to basically admit that they don't exist, they don't have authority over you, the quickest thing and the best thing for them to do is just to get you out of the courtroom. And I've experienced this time after time. In the last year, I've helped people with 6 different cases. 4 of those 6 cases got just completely thrown out. One of them was already past judgment, and I helped them like a year after the judgment when they were trying to send him back to jail. And we got a year of jail and a year of probation, whittled down to 4 days in jail and 3 months of probation. And if I would have been able to help him from the get, it probably would have never even turned into anything. But just by going in there with that basic understanding that you're going against a legal fiction, something that's not real and doesn't really have authority over you, by going in with that mindset and asking questions to try and basically get them to prove you wrong or prove your assumption wrong, it basically comes down to you want them to prove something that they've imagined, and they can't do it. And I would say, in my own experience, about 80% of the time, the fastest and easiest thing for them to do is just to throw you out before anybody else realizes what you're talking about or realizes what you're doing. And they usually come up with some BS excuse, and they just pull something out of thin air and say, we're dismissing it because of this. And they never really give you straight answers. But, I mean, when you get in there and you know that in your heart you're right, there's no victim, there's nobody that has any kind of claim against you, and you can get these people to respect that, it basically takes me and you and a lot of the people listening to this, we're probably hip to a lot of really scary things that are going on, and we're probably hip to a lot of really devious things that our government is doing. And when you can walk into a courtroom and you know that you're in the right, and you know that they don't have the right to be coming after you, and you can get them to basically admit that and get you out of there as quick as they can, it's one of the most empowering things that you can do for yourself in such a scary situation that we find ourselves facing nowadays.
Right, because if you think about it, and I explain it to people this way sometimes too, if the police or the sheriff or the highway patrol or whatever entity you're dealing with, if they're tasked and their mission and their objective is, you know, to protect and serve as a big umbrella, and you're pulled over for, let's say, your front headlights out, if their goal is to protect and serve the community, so your car is lit up at night to avoid traffic accidents,
They should probably have a whole trunk full of bulbs with them or escort you to Walmart so you can buy one. So then now you've fixed your front headlight and you've been protected and the community's been served. But somewhere along the line, now you owe the state or the county or your city municipality $80. Well, hold on. Who's getting protected and who's getting served now? Because they gotta flip that over. If you try to keep people safe, just give me a light bulb. You know, I can't see my taillights all the time. Light bulbs burn out. You know, and also let's talk about how looking nice and acting respectful, because a lot of people get upset and they get, for example, my wife's been pulled over for a license plate light being out. Not all out, just one of the two. You could still see it. The one license plate light was out and the tail lights, you know, plus the street. The license plate was readable. So, you know, what am I getting pulled over for? The license plate light's out? So a lot of people have beef and a chip on their shoulder and they're angry over the BS nature of the incident anyway. But let's talk about how keeping cool and looking the part and not getting over emotional plays in the front end of this also.
Well, we'll go to that in 1 second. I just wanted to make one more clarification. And like you said, if they were there to protect and serve, they would have a trunk full of burnt out lights or replacement lights for your burnt out one. Like I said, the legitimacy of government goes back to that very same principle. I'm going to give my allegiance to you because you're going to protect me. Well, anybody who has any kind of common sense now, you can look at things like 9/11 when nobody is held accountable for their miserable failure to stop that. Hurricane Katrina, they didn't go in there and protect anybody. You get your, say your car's getting broken into and you call the police and they show up 45 minutes later because your area is not a priority for them, and by the time they get there, your car's already gone. Can you hold them accountable for it? No, you can't. If your house gets broken into and you happen to be a single female, and you call the police and you say that you think there's a burglar in your house, and instead he turns into being a rapist murderer, and the police stop to buy some donuts before they come to check out your call, and by the time they get there, you're already dead lying on the floor. Your family can't go after the police and hold them accountable because there is no duty to protect. They don't have a duty to protect us. That's why a lot of the police cars throughout the nation recently have actually taken to serve and protect off of their cars, because there is no duty to protect anymore. Well, right there, off of their basic laws, once they have given up the duty to protect, they have given up the obligation of the people to be aligned with them. So as soon as they give up the duty to protect, they lose the status of a state, and then they become only a corporation. And so what we've got now is we've got a bunch of corporations who don't have the duty to protect, but they want to act like they're states so that they can continue to reap the benefits of the states, like tax money and the ability to control people. Yet at the same time, since there is no such thing as a state, there is no such thing as a citizen anymore. And if there is no such thing as a citizen, there is no obligation or duty of allegiance. So if there's no duty of allegiance, that means every single rule that they've written, from traffic code violations to murder charges to tax code, all of that stuff, since they've given up their status of a state, since they've gotten rid of the actual legal state and they've gotten rid of the actual legal citizens and they're just pretending now, all of that stuff that they created that we are actually obligated to follow if they do provide a duty of protection, all of that stuff that they created, all of those laws, all of that, you know, these rules and reasons to lock us up, they gave all of that up. They don't tell us that, and they trick us into keeping on believing, but by their actions, you can tell they are no longer a state. I don't know if they ever were a state, but at this point in time, they are not a state, and that's why when you get them, when you ask them factually what is a state, or when you ask them factually how does the statute appear, or you know, create any kind of obligation on me. That's why they can't make it hold up, because they've given up the power of a state. They've given up the status. As far as being able to control yourself, you have to kind of take this from the other people's point of view, and this is really hard to do, especially if you're passionate about where you're coming from. But what I like to do is I always try to look at everything from all angles possible and keep my personal opinion very moldable as new information comes in. I don't try and fit information to what I already believe. I try to fit what I believe to the information that I have. When it comes to like police encounters, when it comes to encounters with the judges and stuff like that, these people deal with not the brightest and best of society, and they have to deal with these people on a daily, hourly basis. Cops have to deal with, let's just face it, a lot of grown adults still live their lives acting like children. If they didn't, there wouldn't be a necessity for a lot of the tyrannical stuff that we see out there. When a cop goes to a call and he's got a drunk guy and a drunk lady and they're fighting and beating each other and there's a kid sitting there crying, and then the next call he goes to, two young guys just beat up an old lady and stole her purse, and then the next call he goes to, some dude's got a needle in his arm and he's pissing his pants on the floor, and then he gets, you know, he's driving back to the station and then he pulls you over because you have a taillight out. He's been dealing with, and his mindset is, every single person that I deal with is a scumbag, douchebag, you know, bottom of the barrel of society. That's what his reality is when he pulls you over. His reality is also, I've got a gun, I've got an entire system, the state is behind me, I'm this person's master. So those are the two things that I want to get out of his mind as quick as possible. Number one, I don't ever start yelling at him. I don't start barking at him. I don't start, you know, I treat him very, very respectfully. I treat him like a human being. I treat him like equal. I never treat him like a master, and I never treat him like they're my master, and I never treat him like they're my enemy, because basically what it comes down to is this is another human being. He's been tricked into believing something that I don't believe. He's been tricked into having one point of view that I don't particularly agree with, but that doesn't make him my enemy. So when I go into any kind of situation with police officers, I'm very authoritative. I stand on my ground. I know that this is just a man. He doesn't have power over me because he's got a blue uniform on. But at the same time, he does got a gun, and I'm not trying to get tased or shot on the side of the road.
Right.
So I'm going to treat him like I would want to be treated. I'm going to be very respectful to him, but I'm not going to allow him to think that he's my master. When it comes to court situations, my main reason for going into court being dressed nice, when I'm out on the streets, when I'm, you know, at work or hanging out doing whatever, I wear baggy clothes. I got baggy pants on. I got a big tall t-shirt. You know, I don't wear all the bling bling and all that, but I definitely dress comfortable, and I dress, you know, in what most people would consider like hip hop clothing. When I go into court, I got some slacks on. I got some nice leather dress shoes on. I got a button up, you know, long sleeve dress shirt. I put a bow tie or a tie on. I put it in a full Windsor knot. I go in there with a briefcase. I speak to them very professionally. I try not to use any swear or slang words, and it's not because that, you know, I'm trying to put on a show, or because I believe that it, you know, the dress or anything, you know, presents who I am or anything. The only reason that I do that is because I'm trying to meet them at their reality and make them feel less threatened by me and give them as least possibility to prejudge me as I can. I don't want them having any negative preconceptions about me. I'm going to walk in there. I'm going to act like I don't know what's going on. I'm going to be very respectful as I can be. Sometimes they piss me off, and it's hard for me to bite my tongue, and I sometimes get real snappy with them. But, I mean, that's just, that's where I need to learn how to control myself. But when it comes to these judges, I think that one of the things that they're doing is, besides just collecting ass tons of money from people, I think that one of the things that they're doing is they're actually acting in their minds as a babysitter type of role over society. And God knows that a lot of people create the necessity for a babysitter type of role. And I think that they feel like because they've been granted with this magical black robe, it's up to them to play the babysitters. And when I go in there and when I act very professional with them and I don't allow my emotions to overcome, I don't allow my anger to get the best of me, my my sense of injustice, this isn't fair, my poor picked on me mentality, when I don't allow that to overcome me and I don't allow my personal attachment to the case to blind my objective, I think one thing that it does is that it tells the judge, hey, this is somebody who knows how to control themselves. And this is not somebody who needs to be controlled. And I think that that same mentality holds true whether it's a traffic stop or whether it's a court case. Basically, if you go in there showing that you have no control over yourself and you don't have any control over your emotions and you start getting angry and yelling and acting irate, whether you're on the side of the road or whether you're in a courtroom, if you prove or present evidence that you cannot control yourself, all you're doing is presenting evidence that some megalomaniac is going to step in and think he's justified in exerting his control over you.
So let's start with from that point there. And if you want to use a personal experience, whether it's a specific traffic ticket you got or a hypothetical, that's fine. You're looking nice. Your temperament's under control. What's the first step? How do you proceed in a basic a no state project mentality with the judge and prosecutor at that point?
This is the hardest thing for people to get because the way the court system works, it's set up like a corporation, and it's set up in compartmentalized. Everybody has certain roles. Everybody has certain jobs. Particular types of hearings have different rules that they have to abide by. And that's the one of the hardest things is to walk into that situation and understand what's going on. So I always walk in there with the presumption that I don't understand what's going on because, number one, I don't. I don't see how somebody putting on a black robe gives them power to make decisions over my life, how my finances should be spent, how my time should be spent. So I have no – I don't understand that. So that's one of the hardest things to get by. But basically, the premise of it is when you go into a court, the burden of proof is on the prosecutor. Whoever's bringing the claim, and this works for civil and criminal, whoever's bringing the claim, all of the burden of proof is on them. They have to prove everything. So really, when I go into a court case, I don't really put anything into evidence. I'm not there to contest the charges. I'm not there to tell my side of the story. I'm not there to get justice. I'm there for one thing. I'm there to get proof from the other side that they have the right to come against me. And so basically that's the whole conception that I go in there. All I ever want to do is ask questions. If you make a statement, the judge can turn around and disagree with your statement. If you make a statement, they can turn around and force you to prove your statement. Because that's the way it works. If you make a claim in court, then you have the obligation to prove that claim. So I don't claim anything. I go in there acting stupid. I don't understand. I have a bunch of questions I need answered before I can enter a plea. I need to understand these particular things. And so if you're going in on like an arraignment, a lot of times they'll just have you speak with the prosecutor. And the prosecutor's going to have a bunch of different questions that you're going to want to ask him. If you're going to go in and talk to a judge, sometimes on arraignment they'll let you talk to judges. Sometimes on pretrials they'll only allow you to talk with the prosecutor and there won't be a judge available. And a lot of times when I'm going in, it goes all the way to a hearing. And when it goes to a hearing, then you have the right to cross-examine your accuser. And at that point is when the burden of proof really starts, you know, becoming a big pain in their ass. And basically all I'm doing is I'm saying, look, because you have me here under threat, duress, and coercion, because I'm here at the barrel, at the point of a barrel of your gun, because I'm here because you're going to kidnap me and lock me up in a box if I don't come and play your game, I'll come and play your game, but I'm going to make sure you follow the rules to a T. And that's the main reason that most people get stuck in jail and all of these things. Because I would say, I don't want to say definitely every single time, but I would say pretty much from everything from minor traffic and drug offenses all the way to murder cases, they're violating almost every single rule that they built their system upon in order to put these people behind bars, in order to collect money from these people. They're violating every single one of their rules when it comes to burdens of proof, and because people never call them on it, they get away with it. So all I go in there to do is, understanding that they don't really have the authority, I start calling them on it and start saying, well, this is what your rules say. Are you able to meet the necessary elements in order to be in cooperation with that rule?
So give like a synopsis, thumbnail sketch, a blow by blow of a let's say just a traffic ticket you've dealt with for your own self, and like what's actually said once you're in front of the judge.
You want to just skip straight to like a trial situation?
Right.
Trial situation, they give you the right to cross-examine the cop. For the most part, where I live at, whenever they get a cop on stand, they ask him a plethora of questions. Did you visually assess the speed of the vehicle? Did you use a radar to reaffirm the speed? When was the last time you had training on visual speed? When was the last time the radar gun was calibrated? Where was your training at? A lot of stuff like that. How, you know, and it's basically just to build up the cop as a reliable witness. Then they'll let you cross-examine, and basically anything that you throw at them, they're gonna try and basically just say, well, it doesn't matter. You could say, I wasn't speeding, my speedometer says I was doing this. Unless you've got video, and even then, it really doesn't matter what you come in with. You could be completely innocent. The cop could have pulled you over. The cop could have pulled you over, broken your taillight, and then walked up and said, I pulled you over because you had a broken taillight. The cop is presumed to be 100% honest, and you're presumed to be guilty when you walk in there. And I'll explain that later. They tell you you're presumed innocent, but you're pretty much presumed guilty when you walk in there. So when it comes your time to cross-examine him, a lot of people try and throw their evidence. Well, I've got this evidence. I've got this picture from the street camera. I've got this witness who says this, and whatever, whatever. That, in my experience, never works. Maybe it does once in a while, but I've never seen it work. So instead of taking that route, which is what most people have been trained to do from their television and whatever, well, if I got better evidence than him, then I can get the case thrown out. Well, that's not how I try it. When I get in there, I basically make him prove everything that he's claiming. And you have to understand all of the things that have to be claimed in order for a plaintiff to have standing. If he says, and these are some things I do just to be an asshole. But if the cop says, I received training to do visual assessments 6 months ago at this particular police department training exercise, and I graduated. And so when I get up there, I say, okay, do you have proof? Do you have some sort of proof with you here today on record that you received training and you graduated from this particular training? And they never do. So I have that stricken immediately. Okay, I moved to strike his previous statement or his previous testimony based off of the fact that it assumes facts not in evidence. And most of the time, the judge will strike it. If he says, I tested the photo radar gun, or the radar gun that morning with the tuning fork, and it tested that it was doing fine. I get up there and I make him just to be a dick. Whether he can prove it or not, I'm just going to hold him to it. You made the claim, I'm going to hold you to it. You're going to say that you tested the radar gun. I want a receipt that's dated, that says it's dated to the exact same radar gun, and I want proof that the radar gun, that's the receipt that you have from that morning, is the same radar gun that you used on me at that particular time. Those are some real simple things. That's just basically getting the concept of what you're going to do. If they're going to make a claim, you're going to make them prove it. So any claim that they make, I make them prove. Then you get more into the nitty-gritty stuff. And this is where you have to understand how the court system works. And this just comes from hours and hours and hours of reading through legal dictionaries, reading through law citations and Supreme Court citations, and learning what rules they have to go by. In order for a ticket to be valid, they have to prove that the plaintiff has standing. In order for a ticket to be valid, they have to prove that there's jurisdiction. In order for there to be jurisdiction, you have to be within the state. In order for there to be your presence within the state actually has to physically exist. So one of the easiest things, one of the most recent cases that we got thrown out, it was one of my homeboys, Jeremiah. It was down in Loveland, Colorado. We had got pulled over. I think we were doing like 11 miles, 12 or 13 miles over the speed limit. We got pulled over. The cop had a grudge. I didn't want to identify myself. He started getting all crazy. Finally, I did, but I gave him a conditional acceptance when I identified myself. I gave him the ID, and I told him that I wasn't agreeing to being the legal identity on there. But that's a whole different side story or whatever.
That'll be for the next interview. We'll go over their corporate fictitious identities.
Right. So when we got into court, typical thing, they ask all the setup questions and they turn it over to you to cross-examine. We got it thrown out in, I think, like 5 questions. He asked the cop, is it your testimony that you pulled me over for speeding on this day? Yes. Was my speeding a criminal activity? Yes. In order for my activity to be a crime, is it necessary for you to prove my presence within the state? Cop says yes, because it is. It's, if he wants to claim that they had jurisdiction, he has to prove that claim by proving you're within their state. My friend says, okay, is it your testimony that we were in the state? Cop says yes. Says, is that an arbitrary opinion or is it based off of facts currently within your knowledge? The cop's like, what a dumbass kid. It's based off of facts currently within my knowledge. So my friend Jeremiah asks the cop, okay, well, factually speaking, what is a state? And if you know what factually speaking a state is a figment of your imagination. If a state is a corporate municipality that exists in the legislative imagination. In order for him to answer that question responsively, he has to say that. The cop basically looked like a deer caught in the headlights. He had no idea what to say. The prosecuting attorney had no idea what to say. He was just looking at us like, what the F? And the judge waited about 20, 30 seconds. Neither the cop or the attorney responded. Jeremiah was like, can I please get a responsive answer to my question? And the judge says, I'm not going to allow him to answer the question. It requires a legal determination, and he's not competent to testify. At which point, I always ask for the testimony to be stricken. Then I say, if he's not competent to testify, I move for his testimony to be stricken. The judge usually doesn't have a problem with it. When he says, okay, we'll strike his testimony, I say all of his legal testimony, including the original charging instrument that started this case, which that's the ticket. And at that point, I've never seen him throw it out like that, but that at that point they realized that they walked into a trap door and they have to figure some reason to get this case out as quick as possible, because even if they don't, I can take it to appeals as long as I object on and make my claims for why I'm going to appeal and take it to appeals court 9 times out of 10, which I haven't had to take it to appeals court, but from cases that I've researched and know about, 9 times out of 10, appeals judges seem to be more honorable when upholding the law than some of the municipal and city and county judges are.
The revenue collectors?
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What started you down this line of thinking? Because there's, and we mentioned a couple times, a guy named Mark Stevens and the No State Project. And for people to wrap their minds around this, like when you, if you're hearing this concept for the first time, you know, people go, well, of course, Colorado's a state. I've seen the map. I've got a globe. I took geography. It's the square, you know, between Kansas and Wyoming and New Mexico. It's right there. You know, I know where Colorado is, but everybody's obviously aware that there's no like border painted on the physical ground. So and if you can imagine standing on the quote unquote Colorado border, is it 3 feet wide? Is it 2 feet wide? You know, is this inch Wyoming and this inch Colorado? You know, it doesn't exist if you're listening to this. Let that sink in. The state borders do not exist anywhere except for in your mind, because a globe isn't real. Your geography book was paper. The state of Colorado doesn't physically exist. Well, so, and then if you define it by the people who live in the state of Colorado, people come and go. There were people there before Colorado was a word, and there will be people there, you know, if this whole continent was underwater. Whether they'd be fish and dead, but so it and that's a really simple but really hard, I think, for people to grip, because this is fictitious. And like you said, an allegiance is a two-way street. If they were there protecting and serving and you were acting dangerous, there would be an obligation for them to reel that in, and then things like court cases and jail time proceed from there. But 71 and a 65 in a highway that's ran by the federal municipalities in a state that doesn't really physically exist, if people can really grip that this is a giant shell game, and like we were saying earlier, if your taillight's out, fixing the taillight should solve that problem. If, you know, you didn't signal, you know, reminding somebody to signal, you know, paying this fictitious corporation, then, you know, $80, what does that purify you? Does that keep people safe now? So the crime, in air quotes, never happened. The state, in air quotes, sent their agent, in air quotes, out to fix the crime, in air quotes, and the solution to all of this is you give them some fake fiat currency and everybody's happy. Which, you know, and that's it's hard for people to grip because it's so simple. But, you know, if you're being dangerous and hurting people, by all means, we, you know, as a society, need some apparatus to reel that in. Or if, you know, somebody's on a murder spree, you know, somehow we've got to quell that. But all of this parking zones and speed limits and, you know, your front license plate is in the dashboard and not on the bumper, your taillight or your license plate, none of this is criminal activity, therefore requires no protective service to be even intervening in it whatsoever. And the No State Project kind of encapsulates that whole line of thinking. So how did you hear about this, and what are your sources? Because this isn't your brainchild, and you know, you obviously stumbled across it at some point. Talk about how you heard about this, you know, where this idea comes from, and some in-depth you know, material people can look to get the bigger picture or the macrocosm to this idea.
Okay. Well, first of all, a little bit of background on myself. My grandmother on my mom's side is Scottish French, and my grandfather is full-blooded Chippewa Native American. And so growing up from my mom's side of the family, my grandfather always told me about the foul stuff that the quote-unquote white people government, and I'm a fairly complected skinned guy myself, but I always heard about what the white people government did to the Native Americans. And on my dad's side, my dad is half Mexican, half Spanish, and he was real heavy. We grew up out on the West Coast. A large part of our childhood was in Los Angeles, and my dad is was when we were young, like real deep into La Raza and La M, the Mexican Mafia. And so from both sides of my family, I was always fed that the government wasn't legitimate, that they don't uphold their own treaties, that it's just a bunch of liars and crooks and murderers. And so that was pretty much my understanding of the government. As soon as I was able to understand government, that's what my conception of the government was, because of the influences that were forced on me. So because of that, things like Ruby Ridge growing up, things like Waco, Texas, things like 9/11 and Oklahoma City, when stuff like that happened, I was very quickly, 9/11, by the time it got to 9/11 the day it happened, I was calling bullshit, and everybody thought I was crazy, but I just knew. I was like, okay, this is just, you know, too coincidental. The whole thing seems like a movie. Oh, well, that's just because it's surreal and it hasn't set in. I was like, no. I was like, it's bullshit. And so I never really bought into the whole idea of authority. I never really bought in. I always thought schools, ever since I was a child, I dropped out in kindergarten. I went to school for 3 weeks in kindergarten, decided to stop going. They had a truant officer come and pick me up for another 2 weeks. I would just leave at recess and not go back. And finally, they were just like, he's not ready to go to school yet. They made me go back the next year, unfortunately. But we were poor, so my mom couldn't afford to homeschool us, which, whatever, I've continued my education outside of public education. So, but I never really clung too hard to the reality that most of mainstream America holds on to. So by the time 9/11 happened and I saw the Patriot Act roll out and I saw all the crazy tyrannical 1984 stuff starting to roll out after 9/11, I got really angry, and I was a musician at the time. Me and my brother were doing gangster rap, and we had a bunch of labels hollering at us, trying to get us to sign with them. And when 9/11 happened, we decided to start putting a political slant on our music, and we thought that that would be one of the most effective ways to fight, you know, the oppression that we saw coming down the road. And when we started doing that, all of the record label offers started drying up. All of the tours that we were being offered started drying up. Everything, basically, it was like nobody wanted to touch us with a 10-foot pole for a bunch of years after 9/11 because of our stance politically. I, like a lot of people, had a lot of anger inside of me from a young child all the way up until that point. And then, you know, a couple years after 9/11, I started finding films like Alex Jones's, you know, Police State and Road to Tyranny and stuff like that. And at first I was like, wow, this is cool. I was like, there's people out there that are doing some other stuff. But very quickly I realized that a lot of the people that were at the forefront of the quote-unquote truth movement, they were using the same disempowering, fear-propagating tactics that the mainstream media was using, and they were, you know, they were adding a little bit of truth in with it, but at the core root, they were still forcing that, you have no power, they're coming to get you, you have to live in fear, be afraid, be afraid, be afraid, you can't do anything. And I got really quickly fed up with that whole mentality, and so I started looking into other things, and from there I kind of got into the sovereign citizen movement, which is kind of a joke, sovereign citizen, because you can't be a citizen and sovereign at the same time. But I kind of got into all of that stuff, started researching right to travel, fought a couple of court cases and lost them. And I just never gave up, and eventually I came across some certain YouTube videos that I was seeing people posting their successes, and so I started looking into the questions that they were asking. And one of the things that was consistent with them is they were always asking questions. They weren't going in there and making statements like I was trying to do. They weren't going in there and trying to prove anybody wrong. All they were doing was saying, hey, I don't understand this. Can I please have some of this explained to me? And just by doing that and backing these judges and prosecutors in the corners, they were getting their cases thrown out. And I was like, well, what the hell is behind this? And so from there, I came across Mark Stevens' stuff. And there's a lot of people who promote, like, volunteerism and you know, almost, I wouldn't say anarchy, but archy is just a form of rule. You know, monarchy is one person ruling, oligarchy, you know, different types of archies. Anarchy, and just means like anti or antithesis or whatever. And just means no. So anarchy just means no rulers. And there's a lot of people that promote, you know, a voluntary society with no man claiming the right to rule over another man. And Mark Stevens was one of those guys, and I'm very much like that. I believe myself to be a sovereign, in control of myself, but not in control of anybody else. And so when I came across his stuff, right away it made sense to me. And as soon as I could, I started utilizing it in court situations. And over the last year, I've used the basic principles of what he teaches in about four or five court cases, and out of them, like I said, four of them got dismissed right away, and one of them, we were able to reduce the sentencing, but the sentencing had already basically taken place, so it was pretty much just damage control from that point on.
And so Mark Stevens, did he coin the term No State Project?
You know, I don't think so. I think that it was somebody actually over in the UK, maybe in like New Zealand or somewhere. It was off of this continent, but it was a play off of the Free Keene Project or the Free State Project that's out in New Hampshire. And it was just a play on words. And they said, you know, we don't want a free state. We just want no state whatsoever. And that's kind of where he has taken his direction, is basically coming to a society where all interactions are voluntary. If you want to provide any sort of service for me, even if it's a service such a meaningless service as protection, you know, if you want to come to me and say, hey, we're going to protect you and it's going to cost you this much money to be protected by us, at least let me decide whether I want you to protect me or not. And that's basically what it comes down to, is nobody, no matter what kind of uniform they wear, has the right to force their reality, their product, their protection on any other man, because we're all created equal, and maybe not identical, but equal definitely. And so I don't agree with everything that he says. I've heard certain things on there that I don't agree with, but as far as getting into court and going in with the basic concept of, hey, I don't understand this and I've got some questions to ask, it makes perfect sense. And if you can go in there with the understanding of it, and he's not the only one doing it. I've come across other people since I started going into this that use similar methods with different questions and are getting the same results, and it's pretty consistent. So it's not like, I've got one person out of 100 who this, you know, crazy fringe theory of law worked with. I mean, you hear a lot of people talking about, oh, the driver's license is not for driving, is not traveling, and whatever. And I've went in there and fought that stuff too, and they just never paid any mind. But with this particular form of approaching legal situations, pretty consistently, I've seen tickets just get thrown out left and right.
Right, and I definitely hope to have you back in the future so we can talk about the traffic stop itself, you know, how these concepts can translate, you know, into a positive experience, you know, from the time that you see the lights in the rear view, you know, until court, that in between time, and also some further concepts of how people can conduct themselves through educating others and resources, you know, things like that. So I definitely hope to have you on to, you know, further the discussion. But do you have a website? Let's run down your contact info where people can hear what you do and a little bit more about your music.
Well, first a disclaimer, a lot of my music was made when I was a lot more angry and a lot less solution driven. So a lot of my music is just a younger, angrier guy lashing out at a government which he felt controlled him at the time. But you can check out my music at rapsheets.com. That's rapsheets.com or myspace.com/thecivilians military. That's my rap group with me and my little brother. It's called The Civilians Military, or TCM. And I also do a political radio show on Blog Talk Radio called Ghosts of the Republic. You just look up Ghosts of the Republic Radio, and anytime I have legal adventures that I'm going through, if I have a case thrown out for a friend, we'll have that person a lot of times come on and discuss how their case got thrown out and what they experienced in court. This upcoming week, I've got audio from my latest experience with the judge, which was quite hysterical. I got her on record making contrary statements left and right, caught her lying on record a couple of times until she just finally got sick of it and told me she couldn't answer any more of my questions. But you can check all that out on Ghosts of the Republic Radio. And I have some pages on Facebook. Just do searches for that, Ghosts of the Republic or The Civilians Military. That's pretty much it. If anybody wants to do some better research, though, markstevens.net, he's got his website there, and he's got all kinds of Supreme Court citations, all kinds of articles about the legitimacy of government. They've got a forum on there where people that are using his methods share what happens with them in court, and most of them are pretty positive experiences. So out of everybody that I've come across their legal teachings, his make the most sense to me, so that might be why I have the most success with them. But when it comes down to it, his are basically getting straight to the meat and bones and facts of the situation. And when you bring up the facts, that's when they lose. It's when you pull back the curtain and see the little man and the Wizard of Oz just disappears, is when you start getting into the facts and asking them questions to prove their facts.
Right. Well, it's you know, this is one of those solutions. I think the average guy can incorporate the concept into his own head, you know, and then start living this way, you know, and we could see this transformation into this better world we all want pretty quick. And I've heard you around on a couple radio shows, plus Ghosts of the Republic, and in separate interviews. And I've heard Mark Stevens, and I hope to have him on in the future, but hopefully he doesn't listen to this, or you don't tell him. You explain it way better than he does. So I had to have you on first to get this idea out there. And since I do shorter broadcasts, I want people to nibble on it, toss it around in their head, and do a little bit of research. And then in the very near future, I plan to have you back up, and we can do a little further in depth and extrapolate it out into other avenues. You know, whether it's finances or credit cards, or there's other besides traffic and court cases, where the No State Project, that line of thinking and that way of living, like I said, can turn this thing around a lot quicker than voting them all out and auditing the Fed, which despiritualizes and disempowers people. We want to spiritualize and empower people. So I thank you for a big piece of that.
If I could just give one final closing statement before we're out, though.
No, yeah, say anything you want.
Okay, word. I would say that number one, the most important thing is living free yourself, and stop looking for you know, Alex Jones to create a free planet. Stop looking for Ron Paul or Barack Obama or whoever you think is going to be your savior to create a free world. Stop. I live in Colorado, and we have a huge thing with medical marijuana going on, and I personally smoke marijuana. I don't advise anybody else to do it. I don't try and force my reality on anybody else, but my big problem with the whole medical marijuana movement in this state is these are people who are going to their representatives and begging for permission to do something that they've decided for themselves that they should do anyways, that doesn't harm anybody, and yet they're still going to go and beg somebody for the permission to do it. If you want to be free, it's not going to be by voting for a new slave master. If you want to be free, it's not going to be by finding a benevolent leader. If you want to be free, the only way to do it is to start being free. So me, I don't go and ask permission to do something like smoke marijuana. I don't ask for permission to do anything. As long as I feel consciously right about it, I know I'm not bringing harm to another one of the creator's creations. I'm going to do what I feel like doing, and I try to live responsibly. I try to govern myself responsibly. I try to live to where I'm not, you know, hurting anybody or taking from anybody. And I try to put out more positive energy, because I've put out a lot of negative energy in my life, but that's just my own personal choices of governing myself. But what it comes down to is, right now, in the middle of all of this tyranny and in the middle of all these cameras and, you know, invasions of privacy and new laws being written every day, because of the way that I'm choosing to live, I feel freer now than I ever have before in my life. I feel freer now than I did before they had cameras on every street corner. I feel freer now than I did before they were deflating the money to basically nothing. And it's because their whole reality has lost 90% of the hold that it had over my mental state and my reality. I'm choosing my own reality from this point forward. Instead of, well, I can't do that because they said I can't do it, or I can't do that because they might get mad, instead of being angry or fearful, I'm just living free. If I feel right with it, I'm going to do it. And sometimes I make mistakes and I have to look back at myself and say, hey, don't do that again, because even though it felt right at the time, it ended up blowing up in your face or whatever, you know. We all have to govern ourselves that way. But really what it comes down to, we're not going to be able to petition or picket or protest in order to create a freer world for ourselves. We're not going to be able to take a free society and shove it on our neighbors, because most of them are plugged into the Matrix and they'll fight and die to protect the Matrix. The only way that we can live free is not by voting, not by protesting. It's just by simply doing that, starting to live free. And once you start doing that, and once you start, you know, utilizing some of these methods, because it's easy to live free until you get pulled over by the police and then you're screwed because you don't know how to handle it. So you got to be responsible and start learning these things. But being able to make your own decisions and know that you're in control of your life is one of the most empowering things. And if people would just start doing that as a whole, like you were talking about with taxes earlier and any kind of situation, if people would just start, instead of trying to vote for their freedom or instead of trying to elect their freedom, if people would just start utilizing their freedom, they would realize that, you know, they don't need the feather, you know, that Dumbo put in his hat to fly, because they had that ability all along. They don't need the Wizard of Oz to get back home. They've had the ruby or silver slippers the entire time. So stop looking for someone else to make you free. Make yourself free, and stop looking to make the people around you free, because you can't do that. You can't force freedom on somebody else. The best you can do is live free yourself and hope that by an example, it has an effect on the people around you.
What I term it, to change the world, you have to start by changing your world.
Exactly.
And once everybody changes their own world, you know, we can come together, you know, in peace and freedom, with no license plates and a fresh sack of cannabis sativa that the Almighty Creator, you know, created himself or herself or itself. So, you know, that land we drive on was there before us. It'll be there after us. these plants we indulge in will be here before us and after us. In the meantime, we got to enjoy it. The word govern means to control. The suffix ment refers to your mind. Their connection with us is all in our head. The borders are in our head. The laws are in our head. The control is in our head. Yeah, they have guns and handcuffs, but you know, you can't stop evil people from being evil. Once we start conducting ourselves in a manner such as sovereign citizens, once we start acting like free people, then we'll manifest it. You know, you couldn't have said it better. This is all in our head. It's that easy to let go of. And I feel the same way. And I've never said that out loud. It was almost like me speaking when you said that. I drive past, you know, 500 cops on my way to work. And I look at all these street cameras and I just giggle because it has no control over me. When I look at the Iraq war, I'm not funding it. I'm not joining it. I'm not scared of terrorists. You know, I'm more scared of the bus, you know, the city bus than Al-Qaeda. So once you learn the reality and you let go of the mental fictions, you know, you can be in a prison cell and be the most free man on the planet. You can live in a police state and be the most free man on the planet. You could live in a state that doesn't allow cannabis sativa, but guess what? It grows everywhere. So what's the state going to do?
Yeah, exactly.